child. It's time to jump in too wild. That's why we got more than two styles. Two and that in the situation is too shy. And though the road is rocky, I'm ready to try the next mile to bring sight to the blind man. It's down to the left child. We will survive. It is time to build in this. Swimming through the waters of Babylon like a rebel fish. Jungleist, specialist, predator and survivalist. Spitting heaven, fire from his lips. Burn a slave driver.
Welcome, listeners, to Time for an Awakening on Black Talk Radio Network, new media for the new millennia. This is history and current events program from a cultural perspective. We find this program necessary because Hosea 4:6 states, "My people are destroyed for the lack of knowledge." But we as a people can turn this around. Proverbs 4:7 states, "Wisdom is the principal thing. Therefore, get wisdom. With all thy getting, get an understanding." Again, welcome to the program this evening with your hosts, Brother Elliot and Brother Richard. The number to reach us to join the conversation this evening is 215-490-9832. That's 215-490-9832. We're streaming live at several locations. You can go to timeforanawakening.com, which is the homepage, and catch the live stream from that location. You can go to www.blacktalkradionetwork.com/timeforanawakening. Again, that's www.blacktalkradionetwork.com/timeforanawakening. Catch the live stream there also. You can go to ourradionetwork.com. Again, that's ourradionetwork.com/timeforanawakening. They broadcast out of the Black Belt and catch the live stream there also. Or you can download TuneIn to any of your handheld devices. TuneIn is a free app. And in that TuneIn search engine, just type in Time for an Awakening. There you'll see the icon and you can stream the program live, even into your car if you have the Bluetooth capabilities or the auxiliary connection. Again, that's Time for an Awakening radio program with the live stream on the TuneIn app. Drop us an email at timeforanawakening@gmail.com. Again, that's timeforanawakening@gmail.com. Time for an Awakening also has a fan page on Facebook. In that Facebook search engine, just type in Time for an Awakening radio program. There you always see interesting content being posted daily. And do me a favor before you leave that page, just hit that like button. That's Time for an Awakening radio program with the fan page on Facebook, and Time for an Awakening Media is there. Always full of the latest podcasts of the various programs on Time for an Awakening. Interesting articles that you can read, download at later times, or share with your friends. And check out that Time for an Awakening Marketplace and our partnership with the BB Toomey. A lot of interesting things being posted daily in the marketplace. African languages classes, economics classes, social systems classes, classes on health. A lot of different things, interesting things that you can check out on the marketplace being taught by professors on both the continent and the diaspora. So check it out. That's the Time for Awakening Marketplace in partnership with the BB Toomey. Make that one of your favorites. Put that in your address bar. That's timeforanawakening.com. Timeforanawakening.com will take you straight to Time for an Awakening Media. Tonight it's 7:10 here in the city of Philadelphia. And tonight we have a special guest joining us, anthropologist, lecturer, and historian Dr. Renoko Rashidi will be with us for an interesting dialogue with one of our great historians. It's always good to have him back on the program, and we'll be right back to get things started after a brief word from our sponsors.
Mr. Moderator, our distinguished guests, brothers and sisters, our friends and our enemies. Everybody is here.
You are listening to Time for an Awakening Media, part of the Black Talk Radio Network. For podcasts or live programming, hit them up at timeforanawakening.com.
All Insurance Incorporated, an African-American owned and operated insurance agency and business for over 20 years, located at 231 Southeastern Road in Glenside, PA, with other offices in Germantown and West Philadelphia. Call now for commercial insurance quotes, homeowners insurance quotes, automobile insurance quotes, notary and tax services, representing over 15 major A-rated insurance companies, offering a discount on all notary services when you call in for a free quote. Call this number, 215-885-2444. That number is 215-885-2444. 215-885-2444. All Insurance Incorporated.
Before your roof becomes unruly, call Dooley. Dooley Brothers, specializing in shingle, rubber roofs, gutters, downspouts, and vinyl sidings. Call for your free estimate today. 215-224-3882. That's 215-224-3882. Dooley Brothers Roofing, the roofing experts you can trust. That number again, 215-224-3882. 215-224-3882. Before your roof becomes unruly, call Dooley.
RG Electrical Inspections provides electrical inspections for realtors, licensed electricians, and homeowners. Licensed and insured underwriter, serving Philadelphia and surrounding area. Call today, 484-268-9837.
Overworked? Suffering with an underperforming company, headache customer, staff, or vendors? Or are you a startup who wants to get it right the first time and avoid the costly mistakes? We turned a $24,000 a year odd job handyman service into a seven-figure high-end custom home builder and commercial contractor licensed and operating in three states. This is just one transformation created for entrepreneurs like you in various industries around the country. Not what you're used to from accounting and business consulting? Well, welcome to New Business Solutions. If you're ready to go beyond advising, coaching, and training and get implemented results, call 301-244-9072. Let New Business Solutions apply the best comprehensive administrative, accounting, operations, human resources, management, sales, and marketing to help you actualize your vision for yourself and your company. From anywhere nationally, call 301-244-9072. Spelled new as in numerous on your device right now. Book your free consultation at newbusinesssolutions.com.
History is a clock that people use to tell their political and cultural time of day. It is also a compass that people use to find themselves on the map of human geography. History tells of people where they have been and what they have been, where they are and what they are. Most important, history tells a people where they still must go, what they still must be. The relationship of history to the people is the same as the relationship of a mother to her child.
From antiquity to the present, our people need to develop a new paradigm. It's time for an awakening. With your host, Brother Elliot. Sundays, 7 p.m., Fridays at 8 p.m. For podcasting or live program scheduling, hit us up at timeforanawakening@gmail.com. Welcome back to Time for an Awakening. And before we get started with our program this evening, I want to welcome in my co-host, Philadelphia activist and tour guide at the African American Museum here in Philadelphia at 7th and Arch Street, Brother Richard. Is with us, Brother Richard.
Yes, sir, Brother Elliot.
How are you, sir?
Matter of fact, I'm doing fantastic. We're having one of my, how do you say that? The guests we have tonight, you know, I've always admired and respected the work and the stamina this man has in exploring, you know, the presence of Africans all over, and that's in really trying to revalidate that point of we are all African people, Dr. Ranoka Rashidi. So I'm really happy to be able to be in dialogue this evening with him.
It was. It's been a while since he's been on. It's good to have him back. I've caught him in between visits. He's, I think he's in Washington now, and he's getting ready to leave to go to Panama, I think. So he's moving around, Richard, and he'll be here next week, and we'll talk about all of that tonight with our special guest, Dr. Anoka Rashidi. I think he's with us here. Dr. Rashidi, you there?
Yes, I am. Pleasure to be back.
It's always good to have you with us on Time for an Awakening with myself and Brother Richard.
How you doing, Dr. Rashidi?
I'm tired. I won't lie to you. It's been a difficult week. I had a slow summer. I did a lot of research. I didn't travel much. I did go to, slow for me anyway, four countries in Central and South America. But mostly I did a lot of research. I put together a 2020 calendar called Black Man of the Nile, and I put together two pieces on the Olmec, an Olmec poster and an Olmec scroll. And so last weekend, I began to travel. I'm in the middle of an East Coast lecture swing. I'll be in Philadelphia Saturday and Sunday of next week, but also the emotional burden of losing my only brother, who passed quite unexpectedly Tuesday. Wow. I mean, just like a bolt out of the blue. So I'm kind of, me and my family are kind of in a state of shock. So it's been a kind of an emotional up and down kind of week. But nevertheless, I'm glad to be on the show and looking forward to a good discussion.
Had he been sick, Dr. Rashidi?
No.
Oh, boy. Okay. Yeah, that's always, you know, the toughest.
His oldest son found him laying on the floor.
Okay.
And that was my only brother, my only biological brother. And like I say, the family is just in a state of shock, but it brings to mind that message of Imhotep, eat, drink, and be merry, for tomorrow we may be a mummy. Tomorrow might be the last.
Yes.
So one of the things about our ancestors that really stands out is that they really lived life fully, and they also lived life in such a manner that they would be prepared for the next life, the transition. As we know that they had this, what we call the admonitions of Ma'at. Ma'at is the moral law of the universe in Kemet, a very, very moral society. And they tried to live life well and fully and with justice and harm towards none. And as a result of that, they were prepared to go into the next life and have their heart weighed on the feather and symbolically be lighter than the feather if they live well. I hope that my brother can, I can say that about him. I loved him very much. And it's nothing like a big brother that has your back and is always there for you. So I hope the ancestors are prepared to welcome him with open arms.
Wow. Dr. Rashidi,
you too.
Today you're in Washington at the Everlasting Life restaurant, I think. And then you're
literally
here.
I just finished. Okay. I just got back to my hotel room.
You're talking about life to your fullest. You know, did I hear you right?
I got back to my hotel room just in time for this, and we were rushing so that I would be able to come up and have this discussion. So that should tell you something about the importance that I hold you brothers in and the high regard that I have for you and the information that you're putting out.
Thank you.
Dr. Rashidi, you'll be here.
Now, let me say from the beginning. Next Saturday, I'll do a presentation in Philadelphia at the Philadelphia Clef Club of Jazz and Performing Arts. That's going to be Saturday, September the 14th at 8 p.m. There is an admission fee. And then the next morning, I'm going to lead a tour also for a donation of the University of Penn Museum, particularly the Egyptian collection. And so that will be my next visit to Philadelphia. And I want to talk about that in the course of the presentation. But for those of who are listening, they will also get a chance to see me. We can meet and greet. That's next Saturday and Sunday in Philadelphia. And I'll give more information and a contact number if people are interested.
Talk a little bit about it now. Well, we'll cover it again during the course of the program. But what would you be lecturing about here at the Clef Club? And that's at Broad and Fitzwater, Dr. Rashidi, in my old neighborhood, South Philadelphia, and Richard stopped
at Grand. I want to thank Brother Akili Nkrumah in particular, who is the principal organizer, my principal host. Now, last year, he had me also. We've been doing this about 3 years now. Looks like we're going to make it an annual thing. And last year I did a presentation also based on a new product, a new calendar called Queens of the Nile. Well, this year we decided to do something different. And the calendar is called Black Men of the Nile, Kings of Kemet and Kush. And so the presentation on Saturday will highlight that, but it's broader than that. It's called the Black Men in History, Warriors, Kings, Prophets, and Saints. So it's going to be a visual overview, I guess you might say, of great black men in history. We'll start at the beginning, and we'll probably go to the end, maybe even make a tribute to Robert Mugabe, president of Zimbabwe, who passed over the last few days, his legacy. So we just want to give a salute to the brothers. And it'll be very visual, almost entirely original photographs, most of which will not have been seen in the Philadelphia area before. So it'll be a treat. And again, it's 8 o'clock next Saturday night. And then the next morning at 11, I'll do an overview of about 90 minutes. I'll take people on a tour of the principal African artifacts in the University of Penn Museum. And I'll give the addresses and details of that in the course of the presentation for those, or the interview. For those who are interested in following up immediately, you can always email me at renoko@hotmail.com. My name is spelled R-U-N-O-K-O. So that's renoko@hotmail.com. Or you can call me after the show at area code 323-803-8663. That's 323-803-8663.
Dr. Rashid, you said you spent most of the summer doing primary research, and you had visited four countries. Talk about the things that you covered down in. I saw some of the things that you put on social media about Lucia and some of the things that had been uncovered in Brazil and some of the countries in South America. Talk about some of the.
All right. Well, I visited four countries. Mm-hmm. In June, I took a group to Peru, and I stayed there on my own a little bit longer after the group left to do some research. Peru has an ancient African history, and it has a modern African history. It has a history. There are black communities there now, one in particular at a place called El Carmen. Peru, first of all, let's just give a little background.
Go ahead.
Peru is a large Spanish-speaking country on the Pacific side of South America. On the eastern side is the Andes. I'm sorry, not the Andes, but the Amazon, which I would like for us to look at a lot more because it's been under assault. But anyway, you have a civilization in the antiquity of Peru before the Inca called the Moche civilization, M-O-C-H-E. And I've seen artifacts from the Moche civilization that seem to indicate an African presence, just like we find in the Olmec civilization of Mexico, the parent civilization of North America. So I wanted to do some research on the Moche, and that was very rewarding. I'll have to show some of the pictures next Saturday in Philly. And then also, the government of Peru has recently begun to acknowledge the African presence there far more than it has in the past. Now, June, the month that I was there, is Black History Month. Okay. So I did a presentation organized mostly by some Rastafarian brothers and sisters and members of the black community that was co-sponsored by the Ministry of Tourism. It was big. It went over well. And then I also visited, in addition to Machu Picchu and the other places that almost any tourist goes, I visited the black community in a town called El Carmen. And these are the descendants of Africans who were brought over as a result of enslavement. There is also a new, I don't know if I should call it a slavery museum or a black history museum. The reason I had a little confusion about that is because, unfortunately, a lot of people associate black history with slavery as though it's one and the same. But the museum is quite good, a lot of interesting information. That was in June. Now, last month, for my birthday, I just turned 65. I guess I'm officially an elder, or at least a senior citizen now, and I feel every bit of it. I visited Panama, Colombia, and Chile. And each country had its own rich experience to offer. In Panama, I went to Maroon country. The Maroons were Africans who ran into the interior away from enslavement and established their own communities, even their own kingdoms. And I went to Maroon country and found out more about the legacy of the African Maroons, and one brother in particular named Bayano, who was a first generation African taken as a result of enslavement. He was probably a king, and he led a group of Africans away from the hacienda, and they formed their own community. Okay. And I found a map with lots of African place names: Congo, Guinea, Mozambique, Angola, Mandinga, all on this map. So that was very, very insightful. Also in that same area, Portobello is what is considered to be a miraculous black Christ, a Christ with black features that is supposed to be able to perform miracles. Okay, so I'd seen it before and I got good pictures. Then from there to Colombia, specifically Cartagena. And Cartagena is significant because on the outskirts of Cartagena is regarded as the first town, the first black town in the Americas. It's called Palenque, and it was founded by a contemporary of Bayano, a man named Biencos Biojo, who apparently was a king, so we did come from royalty, captured in Guinea-Bissau. And he established another Maroon, a free black town in Colombia in 1603. And then from there to Chile, where I was hosted by the Rastafarian community there, and I was able to visit the a pre-Columbian museum where I found many significant artifacts of African people in America before Columbus and before 1619. So many people are talking about 1619, and it's important to commemorate it, but we just want to make sure that that's not the only narrative and that people understand that we have a history before 1619 and that the history of African people, even in the Americas, did not begin with enslavement. Very important to note that.
Mm-hmm. That's one of the things that we find that is, you know, as you say, is very important. And it's important to kind of really develop that narrative so that it is not necessarily competing, but actually empowering as far as our, you know, our presence and our fight as to be African people.
Well, we want to be very clear on that. But we also want to destroy the myth of the docile slave. Mm-hmm. We don't want to in any way minimize the suffering of our ancestors, but we want to be crystal clear that we did more than suffer. That from the time slavery was established or enslavement, resistance began. The first rebellions began at the same time the first captured Africans were enslaved. And so I think that this is a very important point. If you just talk about black history as a result of enslavement, you don't have any problems. You'll get a pat on the head. Right. People will tell you, great. You might get money for a museum. You might get some money for a movie. You might even make Europeans feel guilty, and that's not an easy thing to do. But once you talk about resistance to enslavement, and once you talk about African history before enslavement, you will find that you have very few friends outside of the African community itself, because a lot of people just ain't buying that. You know the people I get the most resistance from? When I talk about the Olmec and the African element among the Olmec are Latinos who tell me, Renoka Rashidi, you are doing the same thing to us that you claim Europeans have done to us. You claim Europeans took away Egyptian civilization from you. And now you are attempting to take away Native American civilization from us. Now, for those who are patient enough to listen, I say nothing could be further from the truth. I don't even believe, like Ivan Van Sertima didn't believe, that the Olmec civilization was an African civilization. He believed, and I agree, that it's a Native American civilization in which a small elite group of Africans appeared at a strategic time in its history and turned it out, introduced how to move large objects in stone, calendars, astronomy, agricultural science. And as a result of that, they were treated like kings. They were treated like deities. So what we're saying is something far more important than that, that a small group of Africans with ancient African technology could have the kind of impact where they would be treated as exalted people, number one. And number two, black and brown people have a history of harmonious relationships, that we don't have to be at each other's throats. And so if you listen carefully, the positions that we are taking are not just significant from a historical point of view, but as a foundation for what we can be about today and tomorrow.
And in relationship to collaborative being of different ethnic people who can work collaboratively and support and develop and create greater things out of that collaborative work.
And that's as it should be. But we also know that there are certain things Black people must do for themselves and by themselves. But I don't need any additional enemies, and I don't want to create any antagonism that doesn't have to exist, because we have a mission ahead of us, and as you know, we got all the challenges we can handle right now and more.
If I may, Elliot.
Go ahead.
And Dr. Rashidi, on that OMEC piece, you know, we say it's two things that comes to mind. Can you have you went to museums and seen people who you can say is a part of that small group of population and place that in a historical moment that came to the Native population and worked with them? I'm asking where did these African people came from, and have you seen remnants or historical artifacts of where they came from to make
of
that
course.
Connection?
Big time. Now, I think the first thing we need to know is that we have the evidence of physical anthropology. And we know based on skeletal remains and the reconstruction of those remains by Brazilian scholars in particular, European scholars in particular, and I say that because you can't say that they're Afrocentric or they have a point to prove or an axe to grind. And the fact that they would identify the earliest skeletal remains in the Americas as African, I think it is important. In fact, they don't say they're African. The earliest skeletal remains that we are aware of are found in Brazil. And there's a debate. And the debate is whether they had the phenotypical characteristics of Aboriginal Australians, who are Black people, or they have the physical characteristics of folks from the continent of Africa itself, Black people. So the only question is, which group of Black folk they represent, but they were Black people. The skeletal remain, the most famous one, is called Lucia. And fortunately, this survived the fire in the Natural History Museum in Rio de Janeiro last September. That skull survived. It's 11,000 years old, and it's been reconstructed, and it has the features of a Black person. That's number one. Ivan Van Sertima, my great teacher, used to say, Renoco, is one thing to say that you were first, but you need to put some emphasis, too, on what we did. And so you have numerous visitations from Africa itself to the Western Hemisphere. The African element among the Olmec is one of them. But you know the story of the predecessor of Mansa Musa of Mali, Abubakar II, who also sailed with a fleet of ships, at least 200 ships, in the 13th century across the Atlantic. And so I have no doubt that there were numerous visitations from Africa to America. Even on one of his voyages, Columbus himself sailed from the west coast of Africa. So African people, with the history of science and technology that they have, certainly would have been able to construct boats to go to the Western Hemisphere. Not only that, there are currents that go from the west coast of Africa. And if you get on one of those currents, if you have enough food and water to survive the voyage, you're going to end up in the Americas whether you want to or not. And so to suggest that African people were not in the Americas is really an insult. Now, you find many, many, many artifacts supporting that in the museums. You have the Olmec heads. I'm going to show you all 20 of them in Philly in my presentation. That's never been done before. There are 20 that have been identified. I've seen and photographed all of them. When Ivan Van Sertima wrote the book that came before Columbus, only 14 have been identified. And now we found six more. So you have those. But you have in Mexico City, in New York, probably even Philadelphia, if I looked hard enough, you have artifacts from pre-Columbian America that are clearly Africoid in phenotype, that are undeniable. And the unfortunate thing is, these things are not taught in the schools of Mexico or Peru any more than they're taught in the schools of the United States. And so a lot of us come away with the idea, all we were is slaves, and I don't want to hear that. So people instinctively in our community tend to turn off from Black history because of that slave narrative. Nobody wants to hear that we suffered all the time, that we picked cotton, that we picked tobacco, that we stole watermelons. But when you talk about Africans who formed their own kingdoms in spite of enslavement, Africans who resisted, Africans who rebelled, that's a little different. And then when you're able to throw in that Africans were able to come to America before Columbus and even show pictures, well, you got something going on there. And I think that's the kind of push or narrative our community, particularly our young people, need.
And it's definitely being utilized. There's something, a political front going on in order to, include that, not just narrative, as you say, the historical artifacts that are being discovered to validate that Africans built or had, I'm going to use the term sovereignty, or their own nations in this hemisphere before and were operating. So, you know, even though, as you say, everybody's saying all Africans were enslaved, there could have been, what's that, simultaneously, social formations that where Africans were subsistent unto themselves, like the, you mentioned the Maroons, like Maroon societies.
Well, there's a problem with the Maroon societies now. Now, history is not just black and white. It's not this or that. It's not so cut and dried. I would say that history is far more nuanced than that. Now, you have the Maroon communities. Now, ultimately, the Maroons came under tremendous pressure by the Spanish, by the Portuguese, by the French, by the English. And a lot of those communities signed treaties with the enslavers. And the conditions of the treaties always had certain conditions. Number one, that the Maroons would be given sovereignty, okay? That nobody would attempt to enslave them again. But at the same time, there was a provision that went, from now on, anybody who runs away, you must return them to us. Mm-hmm. That you can no longer accept people running away. That you can no longer accept new members for your community. And some of the Maroons collaborated with the enslavers and even tracked those black folk down. That's the contradiction in the Maroons. Not all of them signed these treaties, but a lot of them did. And so that's a real contradiction. At the same time, black people were used by the enslavers to fight the Maroons. So even when the Maroon communities were in operation or existed, you had black folk from the plantation that would be guaranteed their freedom or reward if they fought the Maroons, okay? So you have all of these contradictions in history. Sometimes a lot of our people talk about our relationship with Native Americans. And that wasn't always harmonious. You have the situation in Florida of the people called the Seminoles. Now, these are Africans and Native Americans who fought a sustained war of liberation against the U.S. for 150 years. And some of them were never defeated. Some of their descendants are in Mexico today. At the same time, you have Native Americans who were slave owners. And so I think that we need to be bold enough and secure enough to look at the totality of our history and draw conclusions from it and not just pick and choose the pieces that we like and say, this proves my point. That's not scholarship. That's cherry picking.
Okay.
And I think our ancestors deserve the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth when presented, I think will show us for the most part in a glorious light. Mm-hmm.
Dr. Rashidi, you talked about your work during the summer in Central and South America. Let me ask you a question in relation to some of the things happening now surrounding this 400 years of our people being documented here in this continental United States. Our people that are scattered in those areas down in Central and South America, you talked in the beginning of the conversation about established communities that was there prior to enslavement and some of the Maroon communities that was started after our ancestors were brought here in chattel enslavement and escaped. The children or the people that are left from those communities, how do they feel in reference to not only themselves, but other blacks, maybe some of the Maroon communities that are still in existence and some black folks that just live in some of those cities? The reason I'm asking this is twofold. The specials that Gates did about blacks in Central America and blacks in South America. I mean, listen, I like Gates' pieces sometimes because they're interesting. They show you a different light, but Gates has a Eurocentric slant on a lot of his stuff, which kind of taints it for me, and that's me personally. But what he did show...
You're not the only one.
Okay. What he did show is, especially in Mexico, when he was on the west coast of Mexico and some of the areas that you've already visited, you see black folks there that still try to keep vestiges of African heritage, dance, customs, and other things, and still try to hold on to what they were, even though they live in Mexico. Talk about the relationship of those people. I'm quite sure there's a level of ignorance there, and I'm talking about ignorance of maybe who they were, how they got there. But just talk about their relationship with themselves and other blacks in those areas. How do they feel, if you know what I'm trying to say? You're there. You've had an experience of being a world traveler. You've seen our people in all the areas in the continent and the diaspora. What's your gauge on them?
I don't understand your question, brother.
Well,
I mean, try to be as specific as possible so I can do it justice.
Yeah, let me, how can I put it? How do they feel about themselves and about Africans in the diaspora? Put it that way.
Well, these are scattered communities, and they're not monolithic. And so different ones might feel different ways. Plus, it's not something that I've really thoroughly examined. But
okay.
The Maroons that I've seen, the ones that I've had an interaction with, let's say, for example, Suriname, they kind of see themselves as a people apart. But some of these same Maroons from Suriname and also French Guyana went to Africa not long ago. There was a delegation of them, I think, that went to either Cote d'Ivoire or Ghana, and they were received like royalty. And they were overwhelmed by the reception that they had by the indigenous, by the native Africans in those countries. And so I think that they realize that they have a special history, but they also recognize the existence of other black people. But the relationship is not monolithic, and it's not universal. Now, let's talk about the Maroons in Jamaica. Now, they have a series of Maroon communities there. Some of the great leaders are a woman named Nandy. And then you have, and she, in fact, there's an area called Nanny Town. So she's the great heroic Maroon figure from there, a freedom fighter from Ghana, in all likelihood. And then you have in the cockpit country a group that was led by a man named Cudjo. Nanny's people didn't sign the treaty. Cudjo's people did. And they embraced it, at least a lot of them did, to the extent that after the abolition of slavery itself, you have different uprisings and rebellions, because even though slavery is abolished in Jamaica, the conditions for African people were still very oppressive. And so you had, for example, I believe it was in 1850-something, maybe 1859, I'm inclined to say, I could be wrong, an uprising led by a man named Paul Bogle. The Maroons from the cockpit country actually tracked him down and gave him to the British, who hung him. Mm. And so the relationship is not always harmonious. Now, the Rastafarians tend to despise the Maroons. They think they are the lowest of the low. But Marcus Garvey's lineage is Maroon. And so it's a very uneven kind of legacy. And it's difficult to say, to speak in a general sense about how they feel about other Africans, or even how they feel about other black folk in their own countries. I don't mean to dodge the question.
No,
but I'm giving you another answer.
No, because you're touching on, maybe you couldn't get the right words, but you're touching on what I'm talking about. And the reason I'm mentioning this, because you put in one of your social media posts that when you were down, and I don't, escapes me, but you would know, when you were down in a certain area in South America or Central America, that some of the conferences that you had was disrupted by some of the people that had complaints, and they were black folks. Can you kind of clarify that, or tell me, because I know I'm getting it twisted.
Well,
go ahead.
That's interesting, too. Now, speaking of conferences, the first time, it wasn't the first time I went to South America. I think I had been in Brazil once or twice. But my first big journey, I think, outside of Brazil and South America was to Venezuela. And that was 20 years ago. And I was a keynote speaker at one of the greatest gatherings that I've ever been a part of, called the International Reunion of the African Family in Latin America. And it was held in the Maroon community. That was my only trip to Venezuela. And I think Hugo Chavez had just recently been in office, and he himself was talking about African blood running through his veins. So this was a great, 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 great experience. Now, Chile is a very different situation. In Chile, I was embraced by the Rastafarian community, mm-hmm. who is highly mixed. A lot of them have Native American roots. Some of them have African roots. Some of them have are what we would call, what would might be called mestizos. But they embraced me. They organized my program. They drove me around. You know, they tried to lock their hair. We talked about Marcus Garvey. In Chile, for example, you have the Naibingi order, and they have what's called a tabernacle. And the main building, or the first building you went into in the tabernacle, they call Liberty Hall after Garvey, and they have a big mural of Garvey, and they talk about African repatriation and African redemption. I love them. I really bonded with them. Now, that very same evening where we had this Marcus Garvey Day celebration, I spoke at the University of Chile. And this university has been in existence since 1830, and I was told that I was the first black person to ever give an address there, to ever make a speech there. So there are lots of Rastafarians in the community, I mean in the audience and attendance. And there were a handful of just clearly, discernibly black people. And there was one sister, and this was a terrible mistake. We had a question and answer period, because I think it's important to have interaction with the community. And they handed her the mic, and she blasted the Rastas. She said, "How dare you organize this program? He should have been in a black community with black people who need the information the most." And I said, "Sister, these were the people who organized the program, so don't get mad at them. Here I am. If you want me to come and speak in the community, I'm going to be in Chile for several more days. I'd be delighted to do it. Ain't got to pay me nothing. All you got to do is organize the program and get me there." She wasn't having that. So I think this sister was just there to disrupt the program anyway. And so my point is, you have a split. You have a strong feminist community there that seems to be anything anti-male. And they let me have it. Just being a black man, they didn't like me. And then you have the black community itself, which seems to be fragmented and shattered. I know you find that hard to believe, but black folk were divided there.
Okay.
And then you have the Rastafarians who are trying to do their best. And then they all, you know, at each other's throat, and I'm right in the middle of that. It was one of the most embarrassing, one of the most painful travel experiences I've ever had. But I've had a lot. I talked about the Maroons in the cockpit country. Some Maroons literally held me hostage. They came to the conclusion that I was this famous, illustrious historian. I don't know where they got that from. And so after my visit to the cockpit country, a group of them, I think a bunch of crackheads, who also happen to be Maroons, literally held me hostage and put out a series of ransom demands. The tourist police and the police in Jamaica were looking for me all over the place. And I finally, they let me go.
Are you serious?
And these were Maroons, or the descendants of Maroons. So, brother, these are the kind of things that I don't always talk about so much because I don't want to embarrass my host. But travel, it can be dangerous. And it's not always what we like for it to be, but, hey, that's the way it is. So that was Chile, and that's a little bit more about Jamaica and the Maroons.
You know, you touched that. Yeah, listen, by you explaining that, you kind of covered the question that I couldn't really put in words. But I think by just you doing the work, and the few others that are like you that get out here, the Ashra Kwesis, the Manuam Pims, and others that do the primary research, I think by you men's work, this is going to raise the level of consciousness among our people worldwide and stop the ignorance. I think that's what destroys our people is ignorance. of who they are and their relation to other peoples in this world. That's why I love the work that you do, and I hope that you're making arrangements to have this work continued. We'll talk about that a little more after we take our break, because I think it's important that that we kind of pass the baton. I mean, the baton was passed to you, Dr. Rashidi, and I know that you're making it. Okay, all right. We're gonna take a brief break. Well, I guess we'll wait about 8 more minutes. Because there's some areas I want to cover in relation to.
Well, let me elaborate on that just a little bit more.
Go ahead.
One of the frustrations that I have is that I don't fail to get a great deal of recognition. People tell me I'm great, but I don't get too much. I don't get the support that I think that I deserve. And probably many scholars and conscious artists feel the same way. People say, Renoko, you're great. We love you. It's like you're getting a pat on the head. But almost never does anybody say, how can I help? What do you need? What can I do? Now, there are a few of us. There's yourself. There's your brother in the studio. There's Brother Akili bringing me to Philly. There's my brother, the filmmaker, Bob Lott. There are a lot of us. Or there are some of us in the community. But the masses of people, even a lot of the so-called conscious or woke folk, will not step up to the plate. I think more than any group of people I've ever encountered, Black people have a savior mentality. I think that many of us believe that African liberation, African empowerment is a very, very, very good thing as long as somebody else does all the work and the sacrifices. That is wonderful if it's convenient and if it's not too hot. And if it's not too cold and the game ain't on and you don't have to spend any money and you like the people doing the work, even though we say we're at war and you don't have to go too far. And if it's not raining and if it's not snowing and we don't say nothing bad about Europeans, it's great. And I think that we have a tendency to kind of wait for somebody to grab us and lead us by the hand, a Garvey, a Harriet, a Lumumba, a Malcolm, an MLK, anybody but me. And it's discouraging in many ways because I don't think that African liberation, African empowerment is a priority. It's something we do if we have time and if we get around to it. And that is the mentality that we must have to break, that we need to break out of. In other words, I think a lot of us feel that white supremacy is a bad thing, but hey, I've kind of made peace with it, and I've learned to live with it, and I'm making the best of a bad situation. And that's what we need to destroy, that kind of mentality.
I agree with that wholeheartedly. And if I may add, you know, or Lisa, you know, you give me opportunity to go on the soapbox, because, you know, Brother Akili was the president of the Division 121 of University
Great
of Negro Improvement
Institute. Great brother.
You know, and so what happened, as you describe, those individuals, those of us who are able to connect with you, the challenge that we have with connecting with each other to be able to put in place the necessary resources to support the works that you and others are doing. You know, so we're doing what we can, but we're still doing it as isolated individuals, not realizing that there's other isolated individuals that we can be connecting to create an infrastructure which makes us more powerful, you know, than the group who is able to bring a certain number of people together, because it is those organizers that's the most important, it seems to me. And I think that's the
most valuable. I have 108,000 Facebook followers. Mm. 108,000. What if each one of those gave me $1 a year? $1. Now imagine what I could do with that.
Yes.
To continue
here's
your work.
Something that really drives me crazy. You hear about people in our community who are mistreated by Asians in our community who run the retail establishments. And yet we keep giving them our money. We keep going back. In South Africa now, you're having these issues of South African sisters and brothers, Zulu, COSA, et cetera, who are looting some of the business, I hope it's overblown, some of the business establishments of other Africans, particularly Nigerians, and maybe Ethiopians too, but certainly Nigerians. But they ain't messing with the Indians. They ain't messing with the white folks.
Right.
Now, I'm going to say one other thing, and Brother Reggie might say Renoco. I'm sorry, Brother Elliot might say Renoco. I'm never going to let you on my show, but I'm going to say this.
Go ahead.
I'm very troubled by what seems to be a double standard in our community. For example, if a white person calls us the N-word, it's a national outrage, but we do it as a matter of course. Mm-hmm. If a white cop, a racist white cop, shoots an unarmed black man, a black woman, brutalizes a black man, a black woman, we're all bent out of shape. And yet we shoot each other every day, and you hardly hear a peep. To me, a black life is a black life, and it doesn't matter who takes it, it's a loss for our community. If you don't respect yourself, and you use the N-word or the B-word, why would you get, do you have the moral right to get mad when other people do it? So for me, it's been a long time since I've been on the show, so I have a lot to share. And I think I've grown and evolved, or at least changed in some ways. I don't spend a lot of time anymore talking about the mean, terrible things white folks have done to us. It's not that I've forgotten. It's not that I don't know about these things. I put my emphasis on what we need to do to dig ourselves out of the hole that we're in. You can blame other people for your victimization, but for your rehabilitation, your salvation, you have to take self-responsibility. And I don't think we're doing a very good job of that. That's just some things I wanted to share. General statements. I didn't mean to dominate and take over, but it needed to come out.
Hey, Elliot, he's reinforcing what we try to say every
I know it.
two times a week.
I know it. I know it.
So, no, you're a great contribution to, you know, the point that we're making in that effort. So I really am inspired by you continue to do your work and to be able to make that observation of what we have to do personally.
We're going to take a brief break, and when we come back, we're going to turn our attention towards the continent and what's going on in relation to us here in the diaspora with somebody who knows, somebody who's been there and done the work in several countries in Africa, anthropologist, lecturer, and historian Dr. Renoco Rashidi is with us this evening in conversation. You can get involved, too, if you got a question or a comment by dialing 215-490-9832. That's 215-490-9832. 3-2, time for an awakening. We'll be right back.
Listening to Time for an Awakening, Time for an Awakening, with host Brother Elliot and Brother Richard on Time for an Awakening Media, part of the Black Talk Radio Network. For podcasting or live program scheduling, hit them up at timeforanawakening@gmail.com.
All Insurance Incorporated, an African-American owned and operated insurance agency in business for over 20 years, located at 231 Southeastern Road in Glenside, PA, with other offices in Germantown and West Philadelphia. Call now for commercial insurance quotes, homeowners insurance quotes, automobile insurance quotes, notary and tax services, representing over 15 major A-rated insurance companies, offering a discount on all notary services when you call in for a free quote. Call this number, 215-885-2444. That number is 215-885-2444. 215-885-2444. All Insurance Incorporated.
I'm I transformed a $24,000 a year odd job handyman service into a seven-figure high-end custom home builder and commercial contractor licensed and operating in three states. This is just one of the tangible transformations I've created for entrepreneurs in various industries around the country. If this isn't what you think of when you think of accounting and business consulting, then get ready to take down this invaluable information. Are you an entrepreneur suffering with a stagnating company? Have headache customers, staff, or vendors? Are you rebounding from a loss and need help achieving your unrealized potential? Or are you a startup who wants to get it right the first time and avoid the costly mistakes? Hi, my name is Nataki Kanban. If you're ready to go beyond advising and coaching and get results, then call 301-244-9072. Let New Business Solutions recommend and implement the best comprehensive sales, administrative, human resources, accounting, and operations to help you grow into your vision for yourself and your company. Again, from anywhere nationally, call 301-244-9072 or pull us up on your device right now and book your free consultation at www.newbusinesssolutions.com. And just mention you heard this special announcement on Time for an Awakening.
RG Electrical Inspections provides electrical inspections for realtors, licensed electricians, and homeowners. Licensed and insured underwriter, serving Philadelphia and surrounding area. Call today, 484-268-9837.
For 12 years, I and others like me have held out radiant promises of progress. I had preached to them about my dream. I had lectured to them about the not too distant day when they would have freedom all here now. I had urged them to have faith in America and in white society. Their hopes had soared. They were now booing me because they felt that we were unable to deliver on our promises. They were booing because we had urged them to have faith in people who had too often proved to be unfaithful. They were now hostile because they were watching the dream that they had so readily accepted turn into a frustrating nightmare. And so the collision course is set.
The desegregation decisions and other type of legislation and Supreme Court decisions depends upon changing the white man's mind. The Honorable Elijah Muhammad teaches us that our own mind has to be changed. We have to change our mind about ourselves.
In what way?
Well, so he teaches us the importance of moral reformation, a knowledge of self. And for instance, the average so-called Negro, he doesn't think that he can go into business and provide jobs for himself. And because of this, he thinks that he can only get a job from the white man, or he can only get clothes from the white man, or he can only get food from the white man. And we who follow the Honorable Elijah Muhammad are taught that the same thing that the white man has done for himself and his kind, if our people could be if we could be cured of our slave mentality that was indoctrinated into us during slavery, we would realize that just as the white man can do these things for himself and his kind, we can get together in unity and harmony and do the same thing for ourselves and our kind.
I'm not wondering at all about them. I'm concerned with the suffering and the pain of the masses of black people. No one wants to pay reparations. The Jews received over $100 billion in reparations and gets $4 billion annually. A Holocaust museum was set up for them on this soil for over $200 million, and they get $21 million annually just for operating expenses. But the Catholic Church, the Pope, the Jews, the Arabs, white people in general, no one wants to pay reparations to these, the sons and daughters of Africa. So I speak to them. I don't speak to the family of those two Jews. There are too many of us for me to speak to them.
And
And one of the reasons why I'm always happy to come to this organization, because you're the only one, you're the only black organization, again, that understands to put race first. Race first. Race first. And I've had some white folks to tell me that I was a flaming militant, a radical, or whatever all of these names were that they called me. And I said that I am very pleased that you've called me a nationalist, because you could have said that I was a member of the NAACP or the Urban League. So I said, I'm very pleased of the names that you have given. But I said that because we put race first, something is wrong with us. But everybody else puts their own first, because God bless the child who has his own. And so I think that race first is very important. And though we meet in a different venue, we're not at the Slave Theater, we're not at the church, we're now at the Masonic Temple, it really does not matter where we are physically. It matters where we are in our minds. And wherever we meet, as long as we know that we're Africans and as long as we know that we're black people living here in America, we know exactly who we are. You notice you can put an Uncle Tom in any venue in the White House. You can even put him in his. He's going to still be a Tom. You can put him anywhere you want. Well, it's the same thing with us who are strong people. Wherever we are, we're going to be the people that we need to be.
Encourage, let me just say this before our time winds up. And that is, I want the people in the audience to go back and look at the video clip from Roots. It's entitled something like Breaking Kunta Kinte. That scene opens with Lorne Greene sitting in, who's the plantation master, sitting in his office, and then Fiddler comes in and says, we don't want to be too hard on the runaway. Kunta Kinte has just run away and been caught. And so the time comes for him to get his lashing. And if you look at this scene, it's about 9 minutes, and study the scene. Study the role of everybody or bodies that are in this particular clip. And you will find that there is an equivalent role in the political life of our country today, whether it's on the national level or on the local level. There's the black man who actually does the whipping of Kunta Kinte. There's the white man who does the whipping. There's the black man who intervenes with the boss man and tries to save the life of Kunta Kinte. There's Kunta himself, who eventually is forced to admit that his name is Toby. And there's dozens of bystanders, black, who are watching. This is a very powerful scene. And it's an analogy of exactly what is happening in our community today. Let's give those characters names in our community and call them what they are, and then take care of business about that.
Welcome back to Time for an Awakening. It's 8:10 here in the city of Philadelphia, and we're in conversation with anthropologist, lecturer, and historian Dr. Renoka Rashidi. You can get involved in the conversation, too, by dialing 215 215-490-9832. Again, that's 215-490-9832. We do have a call or two online, but I'm going to continue the conversation a little bit more before we take the call. Dr. Rashidi.
I'm listening.
Talk about your reflections on Robert Mugabe, who just passed. I think it was Thursday. And it wasn't in Zimbabwe where he passed. But to talk about his reflections, 37 years as the leader of Zimbabwe. He was 95 years old and took power in 1980 when he liberated Zimbabwe from colonial rule. Talk about what he should mean to us. Not the narrative that they put out. Talk about him from the perspective of your work on the continent in several countries and as an historian, your feelings on then President Mugabe.
Well, like with anything else, I have mixed feelings. Mm-hmm. I visited Zimbabwe twice while he was in power, once about 5 years ago, and I actually I was invited there to participate in the writing in eighth volume of the UNESCO General History of Africa. These began to be published by UNESCO around 1970, 1971, and they deal with most of the range of African history. The first volume deals with methodology or methodologies towards African history. The second volume, there's a lot of emphasis on the Nile Valley, particularly ancient Egypt, but ancient Africa, so forth and so on. The last two volumes deal with the colonial experience. So I was asked to come along with many other people. I think I was the only U.S. representative, a representative of an African in the U.S. to come and work on that. And while I was there, we were given a speech by Robert Mugabe. He was actually there. I was close enough to him to touch him. Got a lot of good photographs on African history, and it was superb. So Robert Mugabe was a great man, fascinating man, a brilliant intellectual, a steadfast opponent of colonialism. And I think that grabbing the land, taking the land back from the European invaders resonated with us. And we think, at least I think, it was a very great thing. Unfortunately, there didn't seem to be an effective plan to do something with the land once we got it back. And a lot of the land was distributed to the friends of Robert Mugabe. To my knowledge, Robert Mugabe died a billionaire. His wife had hundreds of millions of dollars, while then most people in Zimbabwe are very poor and have been forced to flee the country. The other issue I have is that it seems to me that a lot of even our greatest leaders, they start off great, but they seem determined to cling to power as though they are going to be or determined to be not heads of state accountable to the masses of our people, but kings for life. We find examples of this in places like Congo Brazzaville, in Cameroon, in Uganda. People have been in power for 30, 40 years. I think, and you talked about it at the very beginning, that there is a need to build the next generation of African leaders. When Renoko Rashidi is gone, Asha Kwesi, Tony Browder, Manu Ampem, all the people that you mentioned, who comes after us? And we have an obligation to put those people in place so that there is no stagnation, that the movement doesn't end with us. And I don't think that our African leaders do a very good job of that, and I don't think Brother Mugabe did. So it may not be what people want to hear, but realistically, since we're having an African conversation with Africans, I think that we need to be real with each other. I see things in Mugabe that I really admire, but I see other things that I believe we can learn from.
Yes.
I love Marcus Mosiah Garvey. To me, he's the greatest person of modern times, but I don't agree with everything Garvey did. And I think if Garvey had it to do all over again, he would have done some things different. And I feel the same way about Robert Mugabe. But for the most part, I see him as a great man who really is an iconic figure in our history and who really had an impact. And the legacy of Mugabe is not going to die with Mugabe, because the same issue of land ownership and distribution has not been dealt with in South Africa, mm-hmm. and it hasn't been dealt with in Namibia. And so what Robert Mugabe did was set the precedent, and now we have to continue with that.
Yes.
Yeah. If I may, in your travels and looking at the history and looking at the artifacts of Africans and civilizations, you know, looking from that lens, and when we're talking about transfer of power and how those social structures, is there any lessons that you can, you know, from looking at those artifacts, looking at that history and being in those places that you can provide to assist us in understanding why it's generation to the next, if that's a clear question?
Well, if I understand you correctly, let me see if I can give a decent answer. I've been doing lots of presentations on Nile Valley Civilization. A lot of us do, and that's no accident. Nile Valley Civilization is the greatest civilization of all time. And there's a reason why we put so much emphasis on it. We talk about it all the time. We're proud of it. We're trying to reattach it to Africa because, in a sense, it's been taken out of the African place in the Near East or the Middle East. Now, there are many kingdoms in the ancient Nile Valley. There's Tassetti, the first that we know of. There's Mero, there's Kush, there's Kerma, and there's Kemet, the most spectacular. Kemet lasted, ancient Egypt, lasted for thousands and thousands of years. And if you were to ask me, and people do ask me, and I emphasize this, what made it last for so long, I would say is the close family relationships. So, for example, you can see a particularly close relationship between, in ancient Egypt, the mother and the son, a very close, tender bond. And you can see a lot of those kinds of pieces reflecting that in the museums of the world. Maybe the best example is Amos Nefertari and her son Amenhotep I. But you see something similar to that throughout the dynasties. And I think that this is what made Nile Valley civilization so great, was the close family bond. And you do find artifacts reflecting that in the museum. I'll show some of those next week. And at the same time, it's something that we can learn from in terms of the past. We don't want to just look at what happened to us and how we fell. We also want to look at what made us great. I think that this is the concept of Sankofa, to reach back and fetch the things from the past that made us great and can make us great again. That's how I would respond to that.
If I may,
great, Richard.
Because the other thing that you've been to a lot of museums, and it's been talk about, especially on the continent, you know, wanting their artifacts back. And European museums have been, you know, hesitant and trying to renegotiate, even saying, I'll loan them to you. Do you see that that transfer of those symbols, those artifacts actually going back to continents out of European museums?
Not until we get some power. Mm. See, that's the key. You know, when I talk about history, I'm not just talking about facts and figures and dates. I'm talking about using African history as the shovel to dig us out of the hole, as a tool, as a foundation for what we must do. And ultimately, the aim is empowerment. That's really what it's about. I mean, I want everybody to feel good about African history and all of that. But mostly, I want people to say, what can we learn from it? How can we use it to galvanize, to inspire us, and to provide us lessons for what we have to do to regain power, to regain our rightful place in the world? Kwame Ture, when he was Stokely Carmichael, used to say, if a white man wants to lynch me, that's his problem. If he has the power to lynch me, that's my problem. So I don't care if Europeans like us or not. I care that we have so much power that they can't mess with us. When we have that kind of power, we will not ask to have our artifacts loaned back to us or sent back to us. We will take those artifacts. I feel the same way, and again, this is probably a different position, about the issue of reparations. I believe in reparations. We deserve reparations, perhaps more than any other group of people. What I don't hear people talking about enough is how we're going to make them pay up. Europeans are not going to pay us based on morality because it's the right thing to do. They would have done that a long time ago. And I am not convinced that even the legal route is going to be effective, because you have to enforce in payment. You have to enforce payment. And so it seems to me that everything we do should be about the acquisition of power, so we can be safe, we can feel protected, and we can pursue our own destiny, whether it's getting the museum artifacts back, or whether it's enforcing reparations, payment overdue, or any other number of things. And if we're not talking about power, we're really not serious. That's what I'm talking about.
And when you say that, and I wanted to get your reflections on this, because when you mentioned Amenhotep the First, one of my favorites is Thutmose the Third. And when you talk about power, and going into Eurasia and actually doing that, and the transfer, when you talk about that relationship, because I think it was Hatshepsut was, you know, the regent, queen, you know, while he was being developed. What does the artifact say to you as you looked over that period? And Thutmose the Third and the 18th dynasty specifically, I think it is a lot of artifacts to that period. Have you looked at those?
You have the nerve to ask me about Thutmose the Third, and we only have a Thutmose the Third, mighty man, great pharaoh, a great king, a short little brother with a big head, reminds me of somebody that I know near and dear to me, Renoko Rashi. Just a bad brother. He's in power for 54 years. If you include part of the reign of Hatshepsut and his reign, he's in power for a long time. A warrior king who tradition says conquered 105 nations and led 17 successful military campaigns in person. He is a great builder. And in my opinion, he is really a wonderful role model. You know, he's oftentimes called the Napoleon of antiquity. And that tells you how little power we have as a people, because Napoleon should be regarded as the Thutmose the Third of modern times. And when we write the narrative, when we write the script, that's the way he will be. But he's one of the great pharaohs of all time. I told you at the beginning about this new calendar I have. We got two beautiful photos of him in there. And we have a nice bio of him in there. Hatshepsut was his aunt. The way it was supposed to go, or Hatshepsut's history, Makare Hatshepsut. Her father was a king, Thutmose the First. She married a king, Thutmose the Second, who died at a young age. And Thutmose the Third was in line for the throne, but he was a little boy. Kemet had just been occupied by the people called the Hyksos, and so Hatshepsut was supposed to run things as a kind of a queen regent until Thutmose the Third got into his majority, his manhood. But once Hatshepsut is in power, she comes up with the story that her father was God Amun, who came down from the heavens and impregnated her mother, and therefore she had the right to divine rule. And she was a very effective ruler for about 20 years. And then Thutmose III comes after that. There seems to have been some kind of family dispute, but the nation was not adversely affected by it. And the early part of the 18th dynasty, in which you find Hatshepsut and Thutmose III, is one of the most glorious periods in African history. And some of the great buildings from in African history come from that time, and you can find artifacts from them all over the world. If you go to the Metropolitan Museum of Art in New York City, since we're talking about museums, they have a whole room dedicated to Hatshepsut and many, many artifacts from there. In the Musée du Louvre in Paris, on my last visit, I found something or noticed something that I had never paid any attention to before. And that is, there is a chapel, a shrine that Thutmose III built, and it has the names of all of his ancestors inscribed there. And so even then, these Africans understood the importance of history and the veneration of the ancestor, that they would be nothing without those that came before them, and they acknowledged them consistently. So he's a great man, and his auntie was a great woman.
Let's grab a call here. Let's go to 484. Are you there? 484. Let's put them back on hold. Maybe they stepped away from the phone. Let's go to, what's that, 215. Let's go to 215. 215, are you there? 215.
Yeah, is that me, bro?
Yes, sir.
Yeah. I got three quick questions for him. Who was the original people of North America, number one? Number two, in terms
Black
of...
people of African heritage. Okay. Number two?
Yeah. Then with Ho Chi Minh, his stay here in America, was he ever a follower of Marcus Garvey? Did he work with Garvey?
I can't say that he worked with Garvey, and I can't say that he was a follower of Garvey. But I do know that he attended UNIA meetings, and he seems to have been very much influenced by Garvey. Ho Chi Minh, in his early writings, he wrote about the evils of lynching in America. And he lived in Harlem. He lived in New York at the same time the Garvey movement was going strong. Julius Garvey, the son of Marcus Garvey, who I was just with yesterday, we were talking about that, and he acknowledges the debt that Ho Chi Minh owed to Marcus Garvey. And that later comes out during what is called the Vietnamese War, when Ho Chi Minh made a conscious effort to appeal to the morality of African-American soldiers and telling them, essentially, our battle is not with you, that your battle, in fact, is with white supremacy in the United States. So that much we do know about Ho Chi Minh.
Yeah, the reason why I asked that, they got a program here called Pass Up, and it was a Vietnamese teacher there. I think his name was Trans Van Den. And he had told some of the students that when Ho Chi Minh lived in Harlem, he worked was with Garvey, that he studied Harriet Tubman Underground Railroad, and he used her railroad. He used her railroad as a basis for the Ho Chi Minh Trail in Vietnam. That's the reason why I asked.
Now that's interesting. I never heard that before. That the Underground Railroad was the prototype of the Ho Chi Minh Trail. Now that's deep. I'm going to incorporate that in my presentations, brother. Thank you for that.
Yeah. And my last question is dealing with Africa. Now, a lot of people over here, black people praise Barack Obama. And I would say some of the moves that he made in Africa, getting rid of Gaddafi, it seemed like he set Africa, did more damage to Africa than the Berlin Conference of the 1800s.
Nor do I think that we need to single out Barack Obama as though he personally assassinated Gaddafi. I think that's the worst mistake that Barack Obama made, and I think he would admit that. I certainly believe that. But you cannot leave out the Prime Minister of England, the Prime Minister of Italy, the President of France. All of those Europeans played a role in that. So I'm not prepared to lay all of that at the feet of Barack Obama. I'm not saying he did right, and he's worthy of criticism. But if you're going to criticize him, I think you need to put it in context and criticize the whole gang that was responsible for the murder of Gaddafi, not just one man.
Okay, but the reason why I said it like that, because my understanding, when he first ran for president, Gaddafi gave him $40 million, and he gave millions
to I don't know anything about that.
Yeah, it was a doctor named, his name escaped my mind. He was on Sister Filet's show.
Anyway, what is your point, brother? What are you trying to say? Get down to the bottom line.
Yeah, the bottom line is, it seems like black people want to get this guy a free pass. And I don't see where he's any different Bush or anybody else. He put a $2 million bounty on the head.
Brother, I'm not here to debate the legacy of Barack Obama. If you have a question, I'd be happy to try to answer it. But I'm not interested in debating Obama's legacy. That's just not what I'm here for tonight.
I would just ask you, since you travel through Africa, you know, about your. All right, just forget about it now. All right, thanks, brother.
Thank you for your call, sir. Let's go back to this 484. Maybe they're back at the phone. 484, are you there? We'll put them back on hold. Dr. Rashidi, I asked you about Mugabe. I want to talk about what's going on now in South Africa. We seen a couple of months ago that the 54 countries in the African Union were talking about establishing an economy, an African economy, which is progress. But we all know, at least conscious individuals know, that whenever you talk about any type of unifying among black people, and I'm not even talking about on that level, you can talk about 10 black folks coming together to do something positive in the community. Whatever level you're talking about black folks unifying that doesn't agree with white folks or the way they believe, they're going to plan to come after you in some way. So now we see a lot of incidents in South Africa of other black folks being attacked. In the media, they term it xenophobic attacks. I just want to play this clip by Julius Malema and then get your opinion on it, being that you've traveled. I don't know whether you've been to all 54 countries, and you may have, but you've been to the...
I've been to 33.
Okay, you've been to... To me, you've been to the overwhelming majority of countries in Africa. Let me play this clip by Julius Malema, and I want to get your opinion on what he said in reference to what's going on. I'll pull this up here. Give me 1 second.
It's wrong. Crime is crime. Let's deal with it as crime. When it is a white person in South Africa, undocumented, he's called an investor. Not only a white person, including Indians and Chinese. These Guptas didn't have proper papers yet. These Guptas didn't have proper papers. No one dared called them Kwerekweres. No one. But if it was my African brothers, we're going to be called Kwerekweres because they don't have papers. Self-hate. It must come to an end. If it means making the EFF lose votes for that, let it lose votes. Lose votes on principle. Not on political expediency of wanting to appeal. This country belongs to Africans in the same way Nigeria belongs to South Africans. Nigeria is South Africa. South Africa is Nigeria. We are Zimbabweans. We need to do away with this nonsensical idea that was imposed on us by colonizers, by Theresa May ancestors, that we must dislike each other. We must do away with that. Theresa May is coming here to make sure that we continue to hate each other. Look at what we are doing now. We are reclaiming our land in South Africa, saying our people must get the land inspired by our brothers in Zimbabwe. Namibia is following. Let the whole of African continent follow and reclaim our land. That's how we're going to gain our independence. And through the ownership of the continental land, we shall then have a true one South Africa. We are unable to unite because we are divided along colonial lines, Francophones and Anglophones. We need to do away with that. We need to love our African brothers in America when they are being slaughtered, in London when they are being slaughtered. They need to know that we love them here in South Africa. They remain our brothers. Love each other everywhere else where you find one another. Protect each other, Africans, because we are in the receiving end.
I'm going to stop the clip there. Dr. Rashidi, your reflections on some of the things he mentioned in relation to what's going on over there in the continent.
I agree with everything he said. This is the kind of leadership that Africa needs. Frantz Fanon, a great African intellectual and an activist. A lot of people don't know about his activism in Algeria and the fact that Fanon attended the All African People's Conference in Ghana in 1958. Frantz Fanon, in his book, Wretched of the Earth, essentially said that what a lot of so-called black leaders want to do is just take the place of white people, that we just want to take the position of those who oppress us. And I think that this is a big, that's the issue with the ANC in South Africa, that perhaps the Pan-African Conference or Pan-African Congress, and, you know, the history of people like Robert Sobukwe, the spirit of Stephen Biko, those should be the people in power. Most of the leaders in Africa, I would say today, are there at the behest and the forbearance of Europeans. and they have more interest in serving their European masters and increasingly Chinese masters than they do the masses of African people. The land must be distributed to the people that it was taken from or to the descendants of the people who was taken from. And I think that we have to do away with what I might call petty nationalities. I don't care if you're from Nigeria or Congo or Ethiopia or South Africa or the United States. As long as you're an African, you're a black man, and you have an allegiance to Africa and not just part of Africa. I think what's the bitter pill for a lot of us to swallow is that when South Africa, the sisters and brothers there in the Black Consciousness Movement were fighting against apartheid, much of the black world rallied around them. There were movements, as you know, in the United States to get U.S. corporations to divest in South Africa. And so you would think that South Africa and the people of South Africa would be far more loving towards other African people. I think a lot of the violence is probably being stoked up by people who don't have our interest at heart.
Yes.
Because, you know, we do have agents amongst us.
Mm-hmm.
And also there's a lot of frustration in South Africa. I understand unemployment among African people is like 50%.
Yes.
When I went to South Africa, and I've been there twice, I could hardly find a black-owned business. So there's a lot of frustration, a lot of pent-up anger. But we have to focus that anger, and we have to channel that frustration and not take it out against each other. That's what I think. So I'm in total support of Julius Malema. I'd love to see him as the president of South Africa, and I hope that's in the cards for the future.
Okay.
If I may, to turn back to the ancient Kemet and lessons, you know, and your work in looking, you know, for the artifacts that reinforce the lessons that we get from there. And I'm thinking of the 12th dynasty. What lessons do we get out of that you've seen, and the 25th dynasty?
Let me just comment on the 12th dynasty. I'm getting old, so I have to say these things before you forget. you'll find that out one day. Hopefully not for me. The 12th dynasty is my favorite dynasty. Of all 30 dynasties, or 31, the 12th is by far my favorite. It lasted for something like 200 years plus. And one of the things that stands out about that dynasty that I don't see in some of the other dynasties, and we can talk about Dynasty 25 or any of the rest if you want, you have, when the king is in power, when the king is still viral, you know, when the king is still in the fullness of life, he would make his son the co-regent. And so that you had a level of stability and continuity. And I think that stands out in the 12th dynasty more than any other dynasty. I think it happened in just about every case where the king becomes a king. And while the king is still in the fullness of life, he makes his son the co-regent. And so the son has an opportunity to learn about leadership skills. And then he does the same thing when he's empowered to his son. And this went on for the better part of 200 years. For those who don't know, the 12th dynasty, I think, begins in 1991 BC.
Mm-hmm.
And it lasts until about 1740 or 1750 BC. So we're talking about 200 years of unchallenged black rule. And it's one of the high points in Nile Valley history, one of the high points in world history. And it's my favorite dynasty of them all. Sorry to cut you off.
No. Do England have a lot of the artifacts from the 12th dynasty, or are they still in Egypt now in the museums of Egypt?
A lot of them are in the Egyptian Museum in Cairo, which is mm-hmm. moving, by the way. Hopefully next year will be the year the new museum finally opens up. There are some good ones in the Luxor Museum, in Luxor itself, some beautiful pieces found from there. There's some nice 12th dynasty pieces in the Aswan Museum, the Nubian Museum in Aswan. But yeah, the British Museum has a lot. You know, they have a beautiful head, a large head of Amenhotep III. They have some nice pieces of Senusrit I and Senusrit III. The Musée du Louvre has some beautiful pieces from the 12th dynasty. If one thing Europeans do exceptionally well, I'm sure better than anybody that's ever lived, is steal. They stole us, and they stole our stuff. and it's in the museums. You don't have to go that far. You can go. I'm pretty sure the University of Penn has a handful of 12 dynasty pieces, but I tell you a place that really has a lot, and that's the Metropolitan Museum of Art. They have a lot of 12 dynasty pieces, beautiful pieces.
And from the 25th, when we, if I don't want to make a comparison, but because, you know, is there anything, because it seems that have been a different route in the sense of those coming from, I guess it's the South, it's coming and providing some stability in Kemet. Is that so? And what is the artifact, the material culture that exists from the 25th dynasty?
Well, what we call the 25th dynasty is from around, let's say, 700 BC to around 640 BC, 625. It doesn't last that long. It lasted less than a century. And the 25th dynasty, for those that don't know, is largely rulers or kings from the kingdom of Kush in Sudan who came forth and reestablished order, reestablished Ma'at to Kemet, which had fallen into a kind of a disarray. So the kings of the 25th dynasty are the kings of Kemet and Kush. And the most illustrious, of course, is Taharqa, but you also have Pianchi or Pie, you have Shabaka, you have Shabataka, you have the last ruler, I think his name is Tantamani, I believe that's how you pronounce it, and then you have powerful women during that dynasty. For example, you have a woman named Amenirdis the First, and she is the de facto ruler of Luxor, of Waset or Thebes. Now, so the difference, I would say, is that you have their rulers of Kemet and Kush, and that the 25th dynasty doesn't last nearly as long as the 12th dynasty. John Henry Clark says that the 25th dynasty rulers, particularly Taharqa, gave our people the last great walk in the sun. And then you also find that close family bond. For example, this is something I've always been moved about in terms of Taharqa. Taharqa was crowned king of Kemet, king of Upper and Lower Egypt. He came from Kush, of course, his family, and he's coronated king of Upper and Lower Egypt, Kemet. But he delayed the coronation so that his mother would have time to get there from Kush. He wanted his mother to see him crowned king of Upper and Lower Kemet. I've always been moved by that. Taharqa led an army to Jerusalem to save his Jewish allies. As a prince, he leads an army to Spain, according to documentation of Ivan Van Sertima. So the 25th dynasty is a glorious, glorious period. And after the 25th dynasty comes to an end, they continued their rule in Kush itself. You have several Nile Valley kingdoms, Taseti, Kerma, and Kush. Now, in November, and there's still room if people can afford it, and they have the time, I'm taking a group to Sudan. It'll be my second group to Sudan. And we're going to be there for 7 days. The first 2 weeks are in Egypt and then 7 days in Sudan. And you can see the pyramids of Taharqa. You can see the pyramids of all the 25th dynasty kings. You can see statues that have been found in Kerma of all the kings of Kush. And it's just going to be a wonderful experience. So these dynasties really, you know, are dear to my heart. The 12th dynasty, the 5th dynasty, the 25th dynasty, the 18th dynasty, the 19th dynasty of Ramses the Great. And I wish that we knew these dynasties and we knew the history and we knew the individuals like we know the names of great sports stars and celebrities. If African people put half as much history or half as much emphasis on our history as we do the start of the NFL season, we'd be miles ahead.
we're gonna take a brief break, and I know I kept you a little over, Dr. Rashidi, but if you stay with us, because we'll be winding things up.
I'm enjoying myself. I'm good.
About another 15 hours, about another 15, 20 minutes, Richard?
Yeah.
Let's go to the end, as long as you want. I'm here.
Good. We're going to take a brief break, and when we come back, you can squeeze yourself in by dialing 215-490-9832. If you got a question or comment for Dr. Anoka Rashidi, again, 215-490-9832. Time for an awakening. We'll be right back.
You are listening to Time for an Awakening. Time for an Awakening. With host Brother Elliot and Brother Richard on Time for an Awakening Media, part of the Black Talk Radio Network. For podcasting or live program scheduling, hit them up at timeforanawakening@gmail.com.
All Insurance Incorporated, an African-American owned and operated insurance agency and business for over 20 years, located at 231 Southeastern Road in Glenside, PA, with other offices in Germantown and West Philadelphia. Call now for commercial insurance quotes, homeowners insurance quotes, automobile insurance quotes, notary and tax services. Representing over 15 major A-rated insurance companies, offering a discount on all notary services when you call in for a free quote. Call this number, 215-885-2444. That number is 215-885-2444. 215-885-2444. All Insurance Incorporated.
Before your roof becomes unruly, call Dooley. Dooley Brothers, specializing in shingle, rubber roofs, gutters, downspouts, and vinyl sidings. Call for your free estimate today. 215-224-3882. That's 215-224-3882. Dooley Brothers Roofing, the roofing experts you can trust. That number again, 215-224-3882. 215-224-3882. Before your roof becomes unruly, call Dooley.
I transformed a $24,000 a year odd job handyman service into a seven-figure high-end custom home builder and commercial contractor licensed and operating in three states. This is just one of the tangible transformations I've created for entrepreneurs in various industries around the country. If this isn't what you think of when you think of accounting and business consulting, then get ready to take down this invaluable information. Are you an entrepreneur suffering with a stagnating company? Have headache customers, staff, or vendors? Are you rebounding from a loss and need help achieving your unrealized potential? Or are you a startup who wants to get it right the first time and avoid the costly mistakes? Hi, my name is Nataki Kanban. If you're ready to go beyond advising and coaching and get results, then call 301-244-9072. Let New Business Solutions recommend and implement the best comprehensive sales, administrative, human resources, accounting, and operations to help you grow into your vision for yourself and your company. Again, from anywhere nationally, call 301-244-9072 or pull us up on your device right now and book your free consultation at www.newbusinesssolutions.com. And just mention you heard this special announcement on Time for an Awakening.
RG Electrical Inspections provides electrical inspections for realtors, licensed electricians, and homeowners. Licensed and insured underwriter, serving Philadelphia and surrounding area. Call today, 484-268-9837.
I must be measured by my soul. The mind is the standard of the man. With this new sense of dignity and this new sense of self-respect, a new Negro came into being with a new determination to suffer, to struggle, to sacrifice, and even to die if necessary in order to be free.
Hang on to the world as it spins around.
All our people are righteous by nature, wicked by circumstance, so we are going to try to save our people. Take control of our communities. Anybody that want justice, come out of those parties that won't give you justice, and let's have a justice party and set up our own candidates, run them in the cities. Take down the weak, blood suckers of the poor, and cast them out, and set up people that will fight for justice for us.
Because there's a whole lot of illusions about Africa's relationship with other people in the world. There's a whole lot of illusion about our relationship to the religions in the world. And these belief systems that had its origin in Africa, all of them, and there is no exception, turned on African people. I said there is no exception. And there's one thing you have to get through your mind and keep it. Nothing that ever came from the European mind was meant to do anything but facilitate European domination of the world. And I said, there's no exception. Everything that was brought into this continent, everything, every idea, every so-called religion, was meant to dominate and to control. The Arabs had no illusions about it. The Europeans had no illusions about it. You were the ones with the illusions. And yet every element that went into the making of every major religion in the world started in Africa. Why is it that you are so naive? You let people redress something that you invented, sell it back to you, and enslave you through it.
If we are to defeat the European, if we are to master this earth and take back this earth from the European, then we must outthink the European. We must then be creative. That puts the learning emphasis on the how-ness, the how to think as such, and to the use of knowledge as a tool of mastery. So it's a very different kind of thing. As a result, you see, the control and the paternalism of Europeans over black people. You see, the other thing that we must recognize, even if the European becomes good and nice and accepts us and so forth, the fact that he would still be in control creates a what we might call a benevolent paternalism, which still to a great degree helps to maintain this passive mode of thinking and this passive mode of knowledge.
Welcome back to Time for an Awakening. It's 8:53 in the city of Philadelphia, and we're joined in conversation with anthropologist, lecturer, and historian Dr. Anoka Rashidi. He'll be in the Philadelphia area next weekend, the weekend of the 14th and 15th here in the city of Philadelphia. And we'll kind of get more details on that on his visit when we start to wind up the program. We still got a few minutes left, and you can get involved in the conversation by dialing 215-490-9832. Again, that's 215-490-9832. Let's go to 225. 225, caller, what's your name? Where are you calling from?
Yes, this is James from Baton Rouge.
How are you, James?
Pretty good. Dr. Rashidi, I'm hearing talk about Thutmose and, you know, conquering, you know, hundreds of people. And, you know, we make moral claims about, you know, the depravity of white people, you know, how they kill people and take their stuff. Well, what's the difference?
Well, I mean, I think one of the differences...
Weren't the Egyptians conquering people and taking their stuff?
I think that what Thutmose did, you have to, I think, put Thutmose the third, and you can judge him whatever, however you want. It's on you. I think you have to put Thutmose the third in the context of the 18th dynasty. Now, up to this point, Kemet had been occupied for about 125 years from people from what we would now call the Near East or the Middle East, called the Hyksos, who occupied Kemet for a long period of time. And so by the time of the 18th dynasty, I think the rulers of that dynasty decided that they had to subdue that area, that they would not allow a territory on the borders of Kemet that would be able to harbor future enemies of Egypt or future invaders. Now, you can call that whatever you want. I'm not here to defend Thutmose III. I regard him as a heroic figure, a fighter, but I think he also saw himself as establishing a liberated zone. Now, Africans fought other folk, too. In the 18th dynasty in particular, you have Africans, Thutmose I, Thutmose III, who were very aggressive. One thing Africans didn't do is rape and rob and pillage and commit genocide in the areas where they conquered. They didn't make people change their names. They didn't make people change their religion. They didn't commit wholesale genocide. Europeans, historically, wherever they have gone, have brought death and destruction, rape, robbery, and pillage with them. I'm not saying African people should be portrayed as having angels, I mean having halos over their head, but there is no way you can compare the conquest of Thutmose III with what Europeans have done historically all over the world. You never hear of a case, maybe you can tell me one, where Africans went and wiped people out. Certainly not Thutmose III. So I take umbrage at that.
So, you know, you were saying that, you know, the point of Sankofa is to look at the things that you've done in the past and the things that, you think are strong to continue those, and the things you think are weak to not continue. Are you suggesting that the notion of conquering other people is a good thing, that that's what we should aspire to do?
I didn't say that. That's you saying that, or that's what
well,
you
no,
think
I
to
mean,
be suggesting
if you,
that
if
I'm
you,
saying.
If you elevate
no,
that note,
let me answer the question.
Impression.
Let me answer the question. I'm not saying that. Simple.
White people elevate Napoleon and Alexander, and that means they
I'm
want
not
to
elevating
emulate
Napoleon
his behavior.
And Alexander.
And
but I don't want to be responsible for what
you
white
just
people
said
do.
That he's a Napoleon.
I said, if you listen to me, that Napoleon is called Thutmose III has been called by Europeans the Napoleon of antiquity. I'm saying that the world in which we live, if it was a world in which African people were in power, Napoleon more likely would be called the Thutmose of modern times. Now,
right.
I'm not
and
here
that
to
means,
argue with that,
that
or create
that
a moral equivalency
it.
Of it. If you have a question, I'll try to answer. But I'm not interested in debating morality.
No, you're advancing morality because you're basically telling us that what we
I'm
need
asking
to do
you
is,
if
is
you
to,
have a question
is to liberate
me.
Ourselves. I'm asking you, do you think conquering people is a good thing?
I think you have to put it in context, and you have to even define what conquest is or what conquering is.
Well,
I don't
conquering
necessarily
hundreds of people, that's more than just, you know, defensive. That sounds like that's aggressive.
Well, let me,
what it sounds like to you.
Caller, let me ask you this. The mindset that our people have of self-hate, of acquiescing to Europeans no matter what it is, and being dominated, do you think that needs to be defeated?
Yes. I mean,
okay.
really, it's the equivalent of a bully coming into your school and terrorizing the school, and you're saying, well, look, we've got to do some things to stop this bully. But it's another thing to basically say, oh, and we should become the bullies. In fact, one of the
well,
things
no, no,
that
no, that's not what was said. But that was,
I
that's
didn't say that, and I'm not going to defend
yeah,
that statement.
That's not what was said. Caller, that's not what was said. You're absolutely
well,
right. Wait
that
a minute,
Dr.
caller. Caller.
Was that
caller.
African leader.
Say that.
Caller. You're absolutely
one
right.
One of the
saying
things that Dr. Rashidi mentioned was that previous African leaders simply wanted to replace Europeans.
No, he doesn't.
No,
when
he
did he
say
that?
That?
Where did you get that from? Were you listening to the program? Nobody
didn't
said that.
Say
he
that
didn't
that
say
that. That was one of the critiques of when you were talking about Mugabe, that there, in other words, when he got the land and didn't distribute it to the people, weren't you in effect saying that that they didn't want to be subject to European authority, but at the same time
he
they
said
didn't
that's
want
the
to
fault.
Their
he did not
that,
say,
he said that
he
was
did
the
not
fault of
that.
Some of the leaders now. That was the fault of them. Did you hear that part?
Yes, right. He,
okay,
right,
so
he,
what's
he was
the problem?
That as a critique, right? That's what I'm saying.
So what's the problem? That is a problem. Well, when they want to get in there and act like black Europeans or white, a black, white European, whatever. It's a mindset that has to be defeated. That's what we're talking about.
But I'm saying this imperial vision is no different than the vision that you're talking about.
No,
in other
no.
Words, if you're going to critique folks that want to aggrandize power to themselves, then you got to critique, you know, these fellows that want to be empire builders.
I hear you. I don't know how you contextualize that from what he said or what I heard. And he said it again, if I'm not mistaken, it was a defensive, because when you read the text, or at least, and I can't read Metanetra, but you read the text, what the Jesus did
was come in and dominated Kemet in the text that, and if I'm not mistaken, correct me if I'm wrong, Dr. Rashidi, you said what they did was they wanted to make sure that that wouldn't, in coming back, that they went into that territory and, you know, that as a defensive mechanism, but they did not do what Europeans have been historically shown to do, is decimate a people, redefine a people out of human history, or destroy the areas that they came to. I that's what I heard them say. So I don't know how
let me clarify then. And so there's no ifs, and buts about it. You can take Thutmose III's conquest with pride, or it doesn't really matter to me. I'm at least glad to know that black people fought back, that they were not simply passive. Now, you can take that for whatever you want. I will add to that, that when Africans conquered in ancient times, whether it be the military conquest of the 18th dynasty or the 18th dynasty or the 19th dynasty, or the Moors going into Spain, they did not wipe people out. They did not commit wholesale genocide. They didn't make people change their names and religion. They didn't decimate people like white folks have done in North, South, Central America, Australia, the Pacific Islands, or wherever they've been. And I don't think that it's fair to compare the conquest of Thutmose III with what, let's say, for example, the Nazis did in World War II. And I'm not interested in debating that. I appreciate your point. I appreciate your perspective, but I'm not going to get in an argument about it. And I hope that works for you.
Let's go to 602.
Yes, Brother Elliot, Brother Richard, and good evening, Dr. Rashidi.
Good evening.
You know, I want to slaughter my enemy. You know what I'm saying? So I don't know what that Dr. Pugh was saying, but me, I want to step on my enemy's neck. You see what I'm saying? I want revenge. Revenge is sweeter than sex to me. But Doc, we love your work, and we go, you know, just leave us the information and we can get some of those books, because I love the pictures. I love what you do. You capture the picture. A picture, it says a thousand words. I like what your work you're doing, Doc, and keep on keeping on, and just drop where we can get some of those books, Doc. Thank you very much.
Oh, well, thank you very much.
Thank you for your call, sir. Let's go to 440. 440? Question or comment?
Hello?
Yes, 440? Yes.
Yes, yes. Good evening, Brother Elliot. How are you?
How are you, sir?
I have a question for your honored guest, Mr. Rashidi.
Go ahead.
I just have one question, Mr. Rashidi.
I'm listening.
Hello. Okay. I have a copy of your book, The Black Starred African Presidents in Early Europe. I just have one question for you, sir, and this is just a pretty general question. When did Europe stop becoming black? Like, you know, there's various parts of Europe, you know, like Scandinavia, you know, Britain, Spain, Western Europe, Greece. When did Europe stop becoming black? Because I understand, like, historically, in deep history, you know, Africans were all over Europe, and then the Asians came in waves. But can you give a brief timeline of that, sir? Because I'm really curious about that. And I'll take my answer off the line.
Thank you, sir,
well,
for your call.
You know, you see a lot of reconstructions based on, I guess, DNA analysis and skeletal remains of African people in European antiquity. For example, the most recent, I think, is the reconstruction of what is called Cheddar Man. And Cheddar apparently is a town or archaeological site in northern England. And more than a century ago, bones were dug up and they've been reconstructed, and they are the features of a black person, heavily melanated man, you know, with blue eyes, interestingly enough. And you have other things that the BBC and other and scientific organizations and institutions in Europe have done to show that the earliest people of Europe were in fact black people. We know that humanity begins in Africa, and those Africans go out to people the far corners of the earth, and Europe is no exception. I would say that it was a gradual process, that those original Africans were eventually replaced, I would say, beginning
process that probably began 30,000 years ago and culminated just a few thousand years ago. But then you have sporadic movements of African people into Europe, just like you have something similar in Europe, in America, in Asia. Humanity began in Africa, and those Africans didn't just sit still. They migrated. So you could say that African people are the original people of the earth. And in places like America and Europe and Asia, they are the first settlers. In Australia, you have the descendants, I think, of those original people. Whereas in Europe and America, those people have largely been absorbed by other folk. I think that people, those original Africans, adapted to changing environments and mutated into what we call white people or Europeans today. I hope that makes sense, and I hope that gives you something of an answer.
Dr. Rashidi, a couple questions before we take it down and put things in your hands and let people know how they can attend the lecture, get books and things of that nature. The I was reading an article last week in the Atlanta Black Star about what's going on presently in West Pampua. That's one of the places that you visited at one time, isn't it?
I've been to West Papua is the western side of the island of New Guinea. I've been in a country called Papua New Guinea itself, which is the eastern side. But I haven't gone to the western side, and I don't know if I want to. In order to do it, you would have to go through Indonesia, and I guess I'm assuming you'd have to fly through Jakarta, the capital of Indonesia, and then go from there. But I don't know if I want to. You know, to me, I have mixed feelings about it. And that means that you might accept or provide legitimacy to the brutal genocidal occupation of by Indonesia of West Papua.
Okay.
I think that we need to know a lot more about it. That it's ironic to me that African Americans, in my opinion, are in the most advantageous position in the world in regards to any group of Africans in terms of the accumulation of wealth, freedom of speech, and movement. It's ironic to me that African Americans, the descendants of people taken out of the door of no return, are now in such a pivotal position to mold and shape the future of Africa and the African world, and to have an impact on the liberation of West Papua, just like we had an impact on the end of apartheid in South Africa, although that's not the end of the story.
Dr. Rashidi, give us any information that you want to give us, how people can get in contact, how they can get the books. One of the callers wanted to know how to get some of the books. The floor is yours.
Well, I'll do all of that. I'll call it a night. I still have work to do tonight. I have to pack. I have an early flight to Cleveland in the morning. I'll be in Cleveland for 2 days doing lectures on called When We Were Kings, When We Were Kings, The Black Man and Black Woman of the Nile. And then Wednesday evening in Cleveland, I'll take people on a tour of the Cleveland Museum of Art. And then on Thursday, I have to go back to Texas to bury my brother. And then I fly to Philadelphia from there. The talk that I'm going to do Saturday night in Philadelphia is called The Black Man in History, Warriors, Kings, Prophets, and Saints. That's going to be Saturday, September 14th from 8 to 11 p.m. The doors open at 7. It's at the Philadelphia Clef Club of Jazz and Performing Arts at 738 South Bend Street in Philly. There's an admission fee. Children under 12 are free. On Sunday morning at 10 a.m., I'm going to lead people on a tour of the University of Penn Museum. The address there's a donation for that. It's a fundraiser for my museum researchers. The address is 3260 South Street. Just meet in the lobby at the opening of the museum. That's next Sunday, the 15th. If people want to get information about the museum tour, the lecture, anything, to make a donation, to organize a lecture, to attend a class, to go on a trip, they can email me at renoko@hotmail.com, R-U-N-O-K-O. That's renoko@hotmail.com. Or they can call me, probably leave a message on my voicemail, and I'll return it at area code 323-803-8663. That's 323-803-8663. And you can always go to my website about information about my tours, my classes, etc. Simply type in www.drrunoko.com, D-R-R-U-N-O-K-O, runoko@hotmail.com. Brother, it's been a pleasure to be on your show. I want to say one thing in parting, and it may have come out of me from time to time in the dialogue. I do not like to have black people attack other black people on my dime. There is, for example, an effort on the part of some people to attack W.B. Du Bois today because of his interaction with Marcus Garvey more than 100 years ago. I was mad when the documentary came out about Michael Jackson. I don't care if he was gay or what he was. I don't see the need. It's frustrating to me when I see black people attack other black people, especially when those people are not there to defend themselves. If you want to attack somebody, attack the CIA, attack the FBI, attack the current president in the White House. But don't take up my time. It's very distasteful to me to go out of your way to attack another African person. We are talking about building unity in our community, and we have to be able to define what that unity entails. Is it just unity with the things that I like, or are we prepared to compromise and look at the big picture? If we say we want unity, it's not about being right all the time or having the last word. It's about building a bond in which a tent in which we can all come together and embrace each other. And I think that's very, very, very important. And that's one of the detriments of our community, an intense desire to attack one another and tear one another down and not look at who the common enemy is. Now, that may be right, that may be wrong, but that's the position that I take at this stage in my life. So I want to thank you all for allowing me to come on the show. I think we raised some controversial points. Hopefully we educated some people, but most importantly, we gave an unapologetic analysis or overview of the African presence in world history. So, Asante.
Dr. Shidi, before you leave, will you have some calendars when you be here this weekend in Philadelphia? Is that calendar for sale?
I have some posters. I have some books. I have some DVDs. So come with a credit card or some money, because we do need money to finance the work that we're doing. When I go to one of these museums, I cannot say, I'm the great Runoko Rashidi, would you let me in for free? When I get ready to go and travel to another country, I can't go to airline, I can't go to American or United Airlines and say, my name is Runoko Rashidi, and I'm going to the British Museum to help destroy white supremacy and photograph the articles. Can you give me a first class seat? That's not going to happen. And so we need each other. We need each other's support, and I certainly do. Nobody can do everything, but everybody can do something.
I know.
And so we have to ask ourselves, what can I do to contribute to my community besides attack one another and critique? Anybody can be a critic. My position is, before you criticize others, tell us what you have
what
done.
What you're doing, exactly. Dr. Rashidi, thank you.
You brothers, stay strong. I appreciate you. And let it not be such a long time before I'm on time for an awakening. I miss you guys.
Well,
yeah, I got a lot more questions, so definitely I'm gonna push Elliot to make sure it happens more frequently.
And then we'll see you this week.
Stay strong.
We'll see you this weekend.
Talk to you soon. Bye bye.
Thank you. Take care. Peace, Richard. Boy, it was interesting dialogue, Richard, tonight.
Oh yes, definitely.
You know, he mentioned something about Du Bois and the debate. I don't know whether maybe it's on social media. I haven't run across it. Maybe you have, Richard. Mm-hmm. But I've heard over in conversation over the years. Oh my goodness, you know what I'm talking about, Richard. With Du Bois and Garvey.
Right.
To Du Bois authority here in the city. My goodness. How did his name just slip out of my head like that? You know.
Tony
Montero. I'm sorry. Dr. Montero and others. Mm. But listen, it was a problem early on, and it got nasty between Du Bois and Garvey and some of the things that Du Bois said in reference to Garvey. But if you read Du Bois' book in, what is that, 1933, Richard?
Mm-hmm.
The Dusk of Dawn.
Right.
He addresses that and talks about his mistakes and talks about him being used by Spingarden and other whites when he was involved in that NAACP. Because by that time, I think he had quit the organization or was kicked out, right, one or the other. So he kind of reflects back on the mistakes that he made. And he does this of his own words. So I don't have to make up stories about what I think about what he did. He critiques himself and basically says that he was wrong in his own words. And if anybody get a chance, and I know if you've read that book.
Right.
Check out the book that Du Bois wrote, and I think it was the date around 1933, The Dusk of Dawn. And I think it was either the eighth or ninth chapter where he kind of devotes talking about the movement and things that he observed and the mistakes that was made and the mistakes that he made. So, you know, I guess when you read these things, it's interesting to talk about it because, listen, we have to talk about the mistakes that all of our elders made. Even when you talk about ancient civilizations, we talk about the successes and the mistakes so we don't do them again. So Richard, it's always interesting to me. When Time for Awakening first started, that was our staple, having the historians on all the time. It's always interesting to me when we talk about our history, because if we don't know our history, then it's almost like a man walking around in a dark room lost.
That's it.
It's important to know the successes of our ancestors so we can know how to move in the future. And I'm glad that I played that clip there so he could hear it in reference to what Malema said about it in reference to what was going on. I don't know whether you had heard that clip that he had put out, Richard.
Yeah.
And it was a little more to that. I just kind of cut it off there just for the sake of time. But a lot of people see the big picture of what's going on. And to me, it has CIA and FBI fingerprints all over that.
And, it's one thing that Dr. Rashidi brought up when we were talking about the Maroons and the different positions that, different in their treaties, which, different groups took, being supportive and or even, as a part of the treaty to one of the roles was to capture and send back enslaved Africans.
Yeah, I mean, look at the language. Look at the language written into the treaty itself. Wow. Go ahead. I'm sorry, Richard.
Yeah, no. When we're talking about our history, and as he said, history is not a straight line. It has a lot of twists and turns. So even the discussion of, well, what is our moral imperative as we deal with our defense? Using our historical reference point should allow us to be able to handle that discussion in relationship to what in shaping our future, whether that is our vision or our future campaigns, in relationship to what is ourself, what is it that makes our makes us authentic Africans as we acquiesce, as Dr. Rashidi said, that the core thing, acquiesce power. Because power is, as Frederick Douglass said, is not something that is given to you. It's something that you have to do in order to actually actualize that. So in doing that, it may be some things you may do that may seem immoral, but it's also of a necessity. But we have to work through that in relationship. Is that action necessary at that moment in time? So good, bad, and ugly. History gives us an opportunity. Our history gives us an opportunity to look at those things and make those kind of choices. And then, know that we're on solid ground, not emulating others, but actually, just stepping out on our own, as our own assuredness as people and of the world. So it's what his work and being able to go and document that, you know, is like valid. I mean, important, but it's also important for us to, as he said, to support people like him. And as you said, to cultivate the next generation. He gave us another example of the 18th dynasty, creating that co-regent right there, you know, to have someone in training for leadership, while leadership is taking place, compared to you're the only one. You know, it's a lot of lessons in our history, and we have a long history. So we have a lot of lessons that we can learn from to deal with our situation right now, is the only point I'm trying to make.
You know, in reference to the caller out of Baton Rouge that made some comments that the brother, Dr. Rashidi was dealing with. Richard, when you, and he used an example of Napoleon and how people would see him when, if they talk about some of the great kings of our history. What we understand, what we have to understand when we're dealing with history, nobody was abusing Napoleon Bonaparte. Nobody was abusing Alexander. Those men went out to abuse other people, and people that they didn't even know. Columbus. Nobody was abusing those people beside maybe their own brother and sister in their countries. But nobody was abusing them. When they were sailing to these lands and robbing, raping, committing genocide, nobody was abusing those people. It wasn't in response to abuse. So when our people are thinking about ways to avail themselves of a white hegemony, white supremacy, however you want to term it, and just like one of our great historians says in our clips, that we have to discuss the howness to do this. You know, if you want to get somebody's foot off your neck, you got to do it the best way you can, because somebody's foot is on your neck. So when you use the analogy of some of those other white generals or conquerors, or however they want to term it, none of those cases, in almost none of those cases, were those men being abused by anybody that they came in contact with. Richard, and if I'm wrong, maybe you can clear me up.
Not at all. No, that's true.
But they did the abusing when they came in contact with people. And some people were total strangers to them. They never seen them before. They didn't know they existed. See, that's the evidence of a demented mindset. You're coming across a total stranger that you never knew existed. These people don't know you. They never came in contact with anybody of those people's complexion at that time. And the first thing that you have in your mind, that I'm going to take what you have, rape your women, commit total genocide, that's a sick mind. That's evidence of a sick mind. I don't care how they want to, how white folks want to venerate these people and hold them up. That's them. That's their ancestors. But that's evidence of a sick mind, people that did that. And they leave a bloody legacy when you look back. I don't think that you can say that about any of our ancestors. If they fought for liberation, that's different. A fight against liberation and somebody that ain't in a fight to just sailing to lands and just wholesaling, killing people. I don't know how you can equate that. I don't know, Richard. Go ahead.
That's the question of, you know, the question of what is the moral, you know, what is the moral compass is a valid question. But the question of whether we have looked at, when we look at our history, have we corrupted, or is our moral compass, as you say, giving examples of, is our moral compass, has our moral compass been the same as what we presently see in our narrative of that? And that's one of, you know, so it, we, and I would, as of right now, I don't see any evidence. And that's why it's important for people like Dr. Rashidi and other historians, you know, who go around and look at our ancient past, or even our present past, and, you know,
evaluate what kind of choices would we made. And I don't think that anything comes close to this point. And I'm not one who is, you know, fully versed in all of that. But as of right now, I don't think that that's come. And I have to say, you know, what's burning in my mind is, I think when that discussion was going on was Hannibal, you know, of Carthage, looking to go into Rome. But when Rome, the victory turned, Rome didn't just, you know, going into Carthage, they didn't just take that area. They decimated the area and salted the land. So nothing can grow again. That's, you know, that's, you know, when we talk about a moral compass and we're looking at history for lessons, you can't, I don't see any example within African present, you know, in the last 500 years or in the last 5-10,000 years of having that kind of campaign, whether it's been a military campaign or a diplomatic campaign, where it was to do that type of devastation to another. I mean, it's been bloody warfare, but it's been, you know, maybe some unequal exchange, but nothing to the degree we have seen, and, you know, to that extent.
Listen, before we wind things up, I do want to give I guess you intend to be at one of those things next week, Richard, either, because I know you mentioned you wanted to go over to the museum.
Right, definitely. I want to, you know, I always want to hear the different historians when they come through, you know, to give the narrative of what's there. And the interesting thing is that the Penn Museum is going through a reorganizing. Matter of fact, they reorganized the whole Egyptian section. So it's interesting. I mean, and they just did it. I mean, it's a new exhibit that they just, the way they reorganized the whole place. So and they're working on the African section. I don't think they've done that yet. But Penn, University of Penn and the Penn Museum is doing a big, you know, a very large project, to the point where they're shutting down. They had to remove some of the artifacts because some of the work that's being done, they said, would destabilize in the drilling and the digging that they're going to do to reorganize that museum. Would be they had to move some of the works out. So it'll be great to have Dr. Rashidi go through and give it, you know, once again, give his analysis of what the piece is there and what they're saying to us.
Yeah, and you know what? I haven't been in that museum, and I'm right here in Philadelphia. I haven't been in that museum in maybe over 30 years. So I don't. Wow, it's been a while since I've been at that particular museum. Yeah, I intend to either go over to the Clef Club or to the museum, one or the other.
Yeah, that's so like as he say, and this whole effort about, you know, museums holding African artifacts and whether Africans are entitled to their property back because of the European thievery and pillage for the sake of their, I mean, and what they're doing is studying us because we've created things that, you know, so these material cultures that they're holding on to, it ain't just to say we got them and they look good. They took the best stuff. And they have academics from around the world analyzing, reanalyzing, reinterpreting to hear some of the stuff they say.
Mm-hmm.
It amazes me, Elliot. And they're recreating narrative still to give them hegemony with our stuff. And we're not, as Dr. Rashidi's saying, we're not supporting those who are really defining where this stuff is. You know, he comes out of the lineage of Jay Rogers, the Sheikh Anna Diop, you know, Ivan Van Sertimus, Marcus Garvey, these men and women who looked at this stuff, you know, and said, These are African civilizations. This was what African, Africans created even the notion of an afterlife. And there was no such thing as an afterlife. You know, so it's a panacea. They're doing it and holding on to it. And here we are, you know, coming up with our imagination about things when we can go be looking right at our, you know, artifacts to give us inspiration to our imagination and be grounded in our own experience.
Inspiration and insight, because I believe if we start looking at our own people's writings, that spirit, it's going to be something that links that spirit together.
Exactly.
That white folks can't, they just can't reach that level. And that's just my own opinion. Again, before we leave, I want to talk about the lineup on Time for an Awakening Media, Mondays, Wednesdays, and Fridays from 11 a.m. to 1 p.m. African Perspectives with Brother Oshi. Always interesting dialogue on African perspectives. And you can catch it 11 a.m. to 1 p.m. Mondays, Wednesdays, and Fridays. From 1 to 3, Black People's Matrix with Brother Franklin Jones. From 1 to 3, and that's on Mondays and Wednesdays on Time for an Awakening Media. From 6 to 8, Monday evenings, Acres of Diamonds with Brother Jihad Ahmed. That's 6 to 8 on Time for an Awakening, Time for an Awakening Media. Every first and third Monday, the program was last week. Conversation Reparations, the Encobra program, is from 9 to 10 on Time for an Awakening. And Warren Valentine's podcast is Night Talk. It's from 10 to 12 Mondays through Fridays on Time for an Awakening, from 10 to 12 p.m. On Tuesdays, Black Reality Think Tank with Dr. William Rogers, from 8 to 10 on Time for an Awakening. On Wednesday, Revive is back, and I think it is back with Sister POC. She was down for the count a little bit, Richard. She tore her Achilles. And she was convalescing there in Washington, D.C., but I think she's back. I think she'll be doing the program Wednesday. So it'll be good to have her back on Revive from 8 to 10 on Time for an Awakening. Thursdays, Relationships with Joy and Troy from 7 to 8 on Time for an Awakening. On Fridays, Time for an Awakening is back from 8 to 10 on Time for an Awakening Media. I want to thank everybody for listening to the program this evening. Lively discussion, as always, and we'll be back on Friday, Lord willing, to continue on this path towards an awakening. Peace.
Peace.
If you're driving through the country on a lazy afternoon, your children playing after school, they seem to be so unaware. I know the things that they'll soon have to take care of. Children, soon it will be their turns to try and save the world. Right now they seem to play such a small part of. Fireman.
Why can't we do something to try and solve them?
To save the children.